Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to create a level playing field for American athletes in Olympic, Paralympic, and Pan American Games? And what should be done about those who break the rules by using banned hormones, drugs, and supplements? The U.S. Anti-Doping Agency is a nonprofit, non-governmental agency devoted to keeping sports clean of substances that could give any competitor an unfair advantage. It's the same organization that last year helped expose Lance Armstrong's long history of drug use, banned him for life from the sport of cycling, and helped strip him of his 7 Tour de France titles. And as my guest today will tell us, the USADA is also devoted to educating athletes, coaches, and kids about the dangers of products that seem an easy fix to training and conditioning challenges. Travis Tigert is CEO of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. He's also an SMU graduate who will speak at McFarland Auditorium on August 27th at 7 in the evening. You can learn about that on the Think page. Travis, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks, Chris, for having me. Good to be here.
Will you start out by giving us a good working definition of what counts as doping?
Yeah, it's the use of dangerous performance-enhancing drugs or methods like a blood transfusion in violation of the rules that apply to sports that athletes participate in.
How did those rules emerge? When did it become apparent that these sorts of tactics were being used by athletes?
You know, there is what's known as the World Anti-Doping Agency that sets the uniform policies on what substances are not allowed to be used to gain an unfair advantage. And it's really, you know, what's going to give someone a performance-enhancing benefit, what's contrary to their health or in violation of the spirit of sport. Those came into effect in 2004. I think prior to that, with the win-at-all-cost culture and the amount of money, quite frankly, that was pouring into sports as it became more of an entertainment type property, the drugs unfortunately went right along with those, because athletes realized that using these drugs made a huge difference in their performance, and if they could gain an advantage, even though the rules, you know, may have been in place at the time, if they felt like they could gain an advantage, they were going to do whatever it took in order to win. So we put a stake in the ground when WADA, as I mentioned, the World Anti-Doping Agency, in 2004 harmonize the rules across global sport, and today there are over 600 sport organizations as well as 200 plus governments around the world who have, including us here in the United States, who have all adopted the World Anti-Doping Code and have a uniform set of rules that protect the rights of athletes to compete by the rules and not cheat in order to win, but also their safety in that process.
Okay, so talk about the scope of the USADA's authority, because I know that like Major League Baseball and the NFL have their own systems of trying to detect people who might be cheating.
Yeah, we have jurisdiction over all Paralympic, Olympic, and Pan Am sports. So it's 48 plus sports that are participated, quite frankly, in year-round on almost every weekend of the year here in the United States. So it includes all of those athletes that you see and that you'll see in 2014 at the Winter Olympics. It included the 2012 Olympic team that you saw on NBC in London last year and hopefully cheered Team USA. All of those athletes fall under our jurisdiction. But it also includes hundreds of events almost every weekend, such as the New York Marathon, such as the Chicago Marathon. I think even in the past we might have tested the White Rock Lake Dallas Marathon, because what happens is the National Federation, as it's known, an entity in the United States, such as USA Cycling or USA Track and Field or USA Swimming, they sponsor or sanction these events, and technically all of those events fall under the Olympic movement, as it's known, in the United States, and it's, you know, 15-plus million people that participate in it, and that, you know, it gives us jurisdiction over those events as well. Of course, our resources are limited. We've got, you know, about a $14 million budget, and we're using our testing resources at the very elite of the elite, those most likely to compete internationally on an Olympic team or on a pro U.S. team like we saw in the U.S. Postal Service's case. But we're aiming our education at every level So whether someone's daughter, you know, one of your audience listeners' daughter or son plays or swims on a summer swim team, for example, they very well could be a seasonal member of USA Swimming in order to compete. And ideally, they're coming in contact with this idea that ethically you have to abide by the rules. Yes, we want to compete and we want to win, but we have to do it the right way in accordance with the rules that apply. And use of dangerous performance-enhancing drugs is in violation of the rules, and you will be sanctioned, and hopefully you're not going to make the decision at that age, especially to use these dangerous drugs.
How does USADA balance the two objectives of, one, protecting athletes from substances that might harm them even while improving performance, and two, protecting the integrity of athletic competition? Is one, does one sort of edge out over the other in terms of priority?
I mean, they're both equally important. Obviously, for our current elite-level athletes, but also for that next generation of athletes, their lives are, you know, fundamentally altered when they lose to someone who has cheated to beat them. And when their athletic dream, whether it's to make a pro team or an Olympic team, is crushed because someone else cheats in violation of the rules, you know, whether it's with doping or, quite frankly, any other cheating, it cuts to the very heart of what sport is supposed to be, but they're the victims, and they're robbed of the opportunity to succeed on their hard work, on their dedication and commitment to their sport. And we truly believe that the biggest injustice that can happen in sport is when one athlete is robbed of their opportunity because another athlete chooses to cheat in violation of the rules. So we firmly believe it's the athlete's right fight of our time, and we're here to protect those athletes' rights. The natural byproduct of that, obviously, is the integrity of sport, and that's good for society. That's good for sports fans. We want to be able to believe in what we're seeing as sports fans out on the playing field.
Travis, what do we know about the conditions that drive athletes to experiment with banned substances or to use them habitually in order to improve performance?
You know, I think the overarching umbrella is, and it's not unique to sport, but it's our cultural phenomenon, especially in the States, of winning at all costs. And make no mistake, there's absolutely nothing wrong with winning, and we want our athletes, and we want our businesses, and the other environments that are competitive in nature to be successful. But I think we have put such high stakes on the winner, and we've lost sight, especially at the youth sports level, but even going up to the professional and the Olympic level, elite Olympic level, that we've put more of an emphasis on just the winner, and the spoils of victory now go to the winner. We lionize essentially those that win, and sometimes we have looked over the importance of playing by the rules and having an ethic and a moral approach to what sport is, which is nothing more than an agreement to play by and compete by the same set of rules. So I think the umbrella, as I mentioned, I think is this win-at-all-cost culture. And look, it's not just at the elite level, and it's not just in sport. It's a phenomenon that we see, you know, in banking, Wall Street. I mean, those that are willing to do whatever it takes to ultimately be successful, whether for money or for athletic success, is a driving force that we're fighting hard to have to counter.
Yeah, doing just a little bit of research for our conversation, I came across a report that Sports Illustrated did a survey of Olympic athletes like in 2000, and something like half of them admitted that they would be willing to take a drug, even if it would kill them eventually, if it allowed them to win every competition they entered for 5 years in a row.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. That got a lot of publicity around the time. I mean, the underlying research behind it was pretty weak, quite honestly. And some of our research indicates differently.
So it's not that bad.
Yeah, I think the you can't miss the point, and all you have to do, I think, is go to a local, youth soccer tournament in Dallas or Little League baseball tournament in Dallas, and again, not to pick on any particular sports, because we had an inline roller skater. A lot of people didn't even know that was a sport, and quite frankly, we didn't hear at USADA either. It's a Pan Am sport until we had a 15-year-old whose father and coach had put him, this young 15-year-old, on one of the most sophisticated drug programs that we've seen with human growth hormone, steroids, insulin, HCG, some pretty potent and dangerous substances, all to make this kid the best inline roller skater that he possibly could be, and more just so the dad could walk around corporate America and have an ego trip telling all his colleagues that his son was the number one junior inline roller skater. So no sport is immune from it, but it's these pressures to win I don't think you can understate, particularly at the youth level. But it's ultimately what drives those at the elite level, if not, you know, already trickling down to the youth level. And as the example I just gave you indicates, you know, athletes where they feel like they can get away with it or succumb to the pressure are vulnerable at young ages. They're gonna do whatever it takes to win. They're hyper competitive to begin with, and their value as people comes through them winning, and only by winning, and that's ultimately what's driving them, you know, to succumb to the pressure to cheat.
So, Travis, we may be hard-pressed to find anyone who would agree that it's a good idea to drug children. But there are people who say, in the case of adult athletes, that they might, in fact, be safer if certain substances that seem to be really commonly in use were permitted but really closely regulated. Can you talk about your perspective on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you hear that. I think it's an excuse, but I guess it's an easy place logically to go when you hear the headlines or you see our U.S. Postal Service case, for example, or the baseball Biogenesis case right now, where, you know, 20 plus people have been sanctioned through it. But I think it's a really dangerous place to go, and I don't think it's a very well thought out place to go because number one, and I think there are at least four what I would call catastrophic outcomes if you suddenly allowed athletes at the elite level, these adults, so to speak, to use dangerous performance-enhancing drugs. One, they're not all adults, but that's kind of an aside. I think, number one, it just moves the line. Mm-hmm. So if you currently have an arms race, all you're going to do is move the line of where the cheating then starts, because what's clear is the more of you take of particular drugs, steroids, for example. So if you tried to set a regulation, it would only move the line where athletes were going to cheat above whatever regulation you set it, because the more you take, the better you're going to do. Another catastrophic one, I think, is it still creates an unlevel playing field because different people respond naturally different to the drugs. Some human growth hormone, for example, as our evidence indicates, one of the riders on U.S. Postal Service's team, that really gave this particular rider a huge benefit when he used human growth hormone. Another rider, when he used human growth hormone, didn't help him at all. In fact, it made him, he felt slower and his legs tired. So you're not going to have a level playing field if you allow different you know, responders to use even the same amount of drugs, if you could even control that adequately. I think the third catastrophic outcome, and maybe the most persuasive to people, and particularly if you have kids like I do, it suddenly becomes if you have to use these drugs to make the elite professional or Olympic team, at what age are we going to accept injecting these drugs to our kids? Because if they have to do it to make the elite Olympic professional team, they're going to have to do it to make the college team. And if they have to do it to make the college team, they're going to have to do it to make the high school team and the junior high team. And pretty soon you're going to have 8-year-olds out there who are using these dangerous performance-enhancing drugs just to make the 8-year-old soccer team. And then the last, and those who, you know, appreciate sport for what it is, it would fundamentally change what sport is, where today it's a set of rules guided, you know, attempting to guide human natural competition, not artificially chemically enhanced competition.
Let me jump in there. We have to take a quick break. I'll let you finish this point in just a moment. My guest is Travis Tigert, CEO of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. We're talking about preventing the use of performance-enhancing drugs in sports. We'll be back to the conversation in about 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Travis Tigert. He is CEO of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. We're talking this hour about the use of performance-enhancing drugs in sports and how that can be prevented. Travis will be speaking at SMU's McFarland Auditorium at 7 on August 27th. You can find a link for more information on the Think page of KERA.org. And Travis, you were finishing up saying that if we allow even regulated doping, it fundamentally changes the nature of athletic competition.
Yeah, I think that's right, Chris.
All right, so let's talk about the U.S. Postal Service team, which many people will remember is Lance Armstrong's cycling team. First of all, why did it take so long to have definitive evidence that could sort of be taken to the bank that there was cheating going on here?
Yeah, we obtained the evidence in May, really April of 2010, when one of the former teammates of Lance Armstrong, but who was on the U.S. Postal Service's team by the name of Floyd Landis, came forward. And he was really the whistleblower. Until that time, they had created, and the sport itself, quite frankly, had created what a lot of people refer to as the omerta, or the code of silence, where those who participated in the doping never talked about it, and many of them took these secrets to their grave, and many had planned on taking these secrets to their grave, and they were sophisticated enough and well-resourced enough where they were able to defeat the testing system that was in place during the time period. So it really wasn't until this whistleblower came forward and said, enough is enough, I want to help move this sport forward, and it was at that point when we began moving our investigation forward, and we had numerous other 26 total, although many more since that time period have come out and acknowledged it. 11 former teammates of Lance Armstrong's on the Postal Service who have come forward and acknowledged it all. So it really took a person coming forward when they did in April, May of 2010.
And you personally experienced death threats after this all came down.
We did. Our office, me, my family. It was a tough time. It's not easy when you've got an icon, a celebrity athlete who's violated the rules to do your job, to hold them accountable. But we know our job is to the clean athletes and to the integrity of sport, and we swore an oath to move forward where the evidence presented itself that people were violating the rules, whether we had a positive test or not, and there was no doubt. I mean, quite frankly, it was the strongest case of doping that we've ever had, and so we had no choice but to move forward, or we weren't going to be doing our job. And while it was tough and difficult, and we certainly don't like those things, death threats. Obviously, we know we have a job to do, and the mission for clean sports, as I said previously, is the athletes' rights fight of our time. And if we're unwilling to bring a case forward, whether it's Lance Armstrong or Marion Jones or any other athlete because of who they are, then we're not being fair, and we're not evenly applying the rules, and we might as well shut down if that's the case.
Of course, an athlete can be disgraced and stripped of titles and lose endorsements. But if it happens after the fact, of course, they still got to enjoy those accolades for some time. How do you prevent the tacit message to other athletes that the real important takeaway is simply not to get caught?
Well, I think on that point, you will get caught. And if you for a period of time, while you might not, your legacy as an athlete is going to be one of disgrace, not of one of as a champion. Mm-hmm. And the only way to keep it intact as a champion is to do what the millions of athletes do, which is compete clean to begin with. And whether you ultimately get the yellow jersey or finish second or fifth or tenth or whatever it may be, do it the right way. And then you don't have to keep looking over your shoulder for the rest of your life to see if your athletic legacy is going to come down and crumbles. So I think that's the powerful message on these high-profile cases. But look, make no mistake, there are tens of millions of athletes out there that do it right. And it's unfortunate that there are just a few within certain sports, especially, that have given the impression that you have to do it in order to win. You don't. And I think what's happened since late 2000, when we opened our doors in 2004, as I mentioned previously, with the World Anti-Doping Agency, having independent organizations who are here to support and protect clean athletes has given millions of athletes around the world hope that they can do it the right way, and they want to do it the right way. It's the very nature of why they ultimately go into athletic competition is to be a winner by the rules that are in place.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also join the conversation via email to think@kera.org. And that's where we hear from Anthony, who writes, how aggressive is your testing for the sport of triathlon as compared to cycling? Do you believe triathlon has the same level of problems that cycling has had? Or what are your thoughts on doping in triathlon?
Yeah, well, triathlon falls under our jurisdiction as well, the ITU, the International Triathlon Union. There's a professional side to that that is outside of our jurisdiction, the World Triathlon Corporation. So it's slightly different in that sense, and those are the Ironman distances, slightly different in that sense than our cycling situation. But, look, I think the temptations are high in every sport. And if you have a less than ideal regulatory system in place, athletes are going to go to great lengths in order to be successful. And so I think, you know, triathlon, I mentioned the 15-year-old inline roller skater. I mean, those are the realities of the athletic world and the competitive world that we live in with our sports. And so I think it's naive to think the temptations aren't there. I hope that the system's in place, at least the ITU that we have jurisdiction over and the WADA code has applies to, have good policies in place, and the testing is ensuring that athletes are taking a great risk if they decide to cheat, and they know, as we evidence in the Armstrong case, even if you're able to defeat the testing for a period of time, there's still a significant chance you're going to be caught and have all your results disqualified. And so the risk and the deterrent is huge, I think.
So obviously there's a great deal at stake for athletes who want to win, as well as for the sort of employment prospects of people like coaches and trainers. Will you talk about how often the temptation seems to be among those who are prescribing nutrition and what may actually be effective pharmaceuticals for treating real conditions, the temptation of coaches and trainers and people like that, doctors, to dope athletes against without their knowledge. Does that actually happen?
You know, I think that's it's we certainly haven't seen it to the extent that you might think. I mean, it's been pretty rare in our cases. I think, make no mistake, though, the influence that coaches, but also parents, and the 15-year-old inline roller skater I mentioned, but coaches have, and our research that you can find, you know, at truesport.org indicates that you know, coaches have the number one positive influence on youth that play for them, and they also can have a very negative influence on them. So we will frequently see, you know, whether it's doctors, coaches, nutritionists, physios behind athletes who ultimately cheat, because the athletes, you know, who are looking for an advantage aren't going to necessarily know how to do it themselves without getting caught. They're going to try to go to a professional to help them do it in a way that they don't get caught. And where they have the resources to hire those people, then they can attempt to do it without being detected through the normal testing process.
Another justification that is sometimes heard is that people say, well, you still have to work hard if you're using these substances. It's not like the drugs do everything, or like, you know, blood doping does everything. Will you sort of take that and give us your sense of that statement?
Yeah, I mean, I you know, the soundbite you hear out there about it that a famous cyclist said is that EPO, for example, one of the drugs the U.S. Postal Service team was using and attempting one, and a very potent one for cyclists, but also other endurance type athletes, that it would take a donkey and turn them into a thoroughbred. Certainly, you have to have some athletic, talents, and you have to, of course, work hard. But the percentage of improvement, anywhere from 10 to 15%, and you tack that on top of a 21-day or, you know, 3-week stage race where there's minutes separating the winner from middle of the pack, and you can imagine a 10 to 15% performance advantage is huge. You add that same 10 to 15% or even, you know, say 1% or 2% to swimming events or the 100-meter dash, and you're talking about game changers. That if athletes equally work hard, one is going to turn them into the champion and the other is not.
So just today we have this former West German soccer player saying a line should be drawn between drugs used to enhance performance and things like human growth hormone being used to recover from injury. Talk about why you would hesitate to draw such a line.
Well, right now, and remember, it's what are the rules? I mean, we have a 10-foot basket in basketball, and that means both teams have to shoot on a 10-foot basketball goal. Not, you know, one team doesn't get an 8-foot, and the other still has the 10-foot. So it's a question of the rules, and the rules right now have three criteria. Number one, it has to be performance enhancing. Number two, you know, potentially dangerous to health and safety of athletes. And it could also be in violation of the spirit of sport. It has to meet two of those three criteria. And human growth hormone, you know, meets arguably all three of them, but clearly meets number one because it's going to add lean muscle mass. Even if you're not injured, even if you're not using it for recovery, it's going to add lean muscle mass. And you can imagine in a sport like, you know, NFL football, for example, or boxing or judo or karate or many of the other types of sports where you want to maintain, you know, lean muscle mass, that's going to give you a huge advantage. So, you know, there is a medical process, I guess, where athletes can apply if they've had an injury, you know, torn an ACL or whatever the case may be, and they need an otherwise prohibited substance. And it's not going to give them a performance enhancement, but it's just going to bring them back to their natural ability. Then for a period of time, they're, you know, through a independent process, that request is reviewed and determined whether or not it's appropriate in those particular cases. So, of course, we want to aid athletes in their health, and we want to, you know, maintain their health, particularly after injuries. And there's a process to do that, but we don't want to carry that over to, you know, medical justification of what really is just doping.
Hmm. Is there a difference in the incidence of doping between male and female athletes?
I don't think so. I mean, again, I think the temptations are there, and I think if you look at, you know, the how, you know, the women's side of the Olympic sports at least have taken off, it's just as fertile. Given the type of money that's now going in to those sports, rightfully so. But I think as any of those sports grow, as well as the Paralympic sports, as they grow and money's being put into them, you know, the pressures to win and the rewards for victory only increase the temptation to use those drugs. So again, I don't think we can be naive, whether it's Paralympic, you know, sports or women's sports or men's able-bodied sports, that the temptation to win is huge, and we've got to keep our guard up to ensure that athletes don't think the only way they can do it successfully is by using these dangerous drugs and getting away with it.
Travis Tigard is my guest. He's CEO of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Talk a little bit about the testing process and how athletes are sort of surprise tested before certain competitions.
Yeah, so we have both in-competition testing, so we'll test athletes after an event, but we'll also have, and where we, you know, put 65 to 70% of our testing resources is out of competition. So athletes literally, you know, provide us their whereabouts. We've got about 3,000 athletes who are the top of, you know, Olympic sport here in the United States, from household names that you would know all the way down to, you know, weekend, you know, table tennis players, for example, who are the best in the world, or among the best in the world, and they literally give us their whereabouts information, and we will execute tests, what's known as a no notice test, where we'll, you know, go to where they tell us they're going to be, and, you know, unannounced to them, show up and have them provide either or both urine and blood sampling, because you have to do both matrix, because not everything is going to be detected just in the urine and not everything is going to be detected just in the blood, but you have to collect both to have an overall effective program. And then those are sent to independent labs that are accredited at the highest level, specialized for sport analysis. They're analyzed. And then the results are sent back to us, and of course, every athlete has an opportunity to be at the B sample, opening an analysis. So there's essentially two separate samples that are collected at the same time. It's, you know, the main sample is divided into two separate bottles. If there is an A positive, the athlete gets an opportunity to go to the lab with an expert or whoever they want and watch the B sample being analyzed so they can have comfort that when it says it's positive, it's in fact positive. And then, of course, there's a full legal process prior to any athlete being removed from their opportunity to compete on the playing field that ultimately independent judges determine whether or not someone has committed a violation or not, where they're simply presenting the evidence that they did or they didn't and what the sanction should be based on what the uniform world rules indicate.
Is there such a thing as false positive results?
You know, scientists will tell you there's a chance the sun's not going to come up tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think the process is robust to the extent that, you know, after the lab analysis of the A, after our internal science review, after lab analysis on the B sample, after the, you know, independent review board, essentially the grand jury, and then independent judges who ultimately make the determination of whether, you know, the lab results stand on their face or not, I think the likelihood of it is zero. That said, you know, there are scientists who'll tell you the sun's not coming up tomorrow.
My guest is Travis Tigard. He is CEO of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, and he'll be speaking on August 27th at 7 o'clock at SMU's McFarland Auditorium. You can learn more about that appearance on the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to be part of this discussion, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@KERA.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking about preventing the use of performance-enhancing drugs in sports with Travis Tigard, who is CEO of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Travis, for your colleagues on the science side of this fight, it must feel a little bit like keeping track with a mutating virus, because the moment they have figured out ways to detect all the things that can be done to cheat to enhance performance, someone comes up with a new innovation or a preparation that has not been officially banned yet. Can you talk a little bit about what it takes to sort of keep up with what is unfortunately a rapidly evolving set of technologies for cheating?
Yeah, we are, and I think it dovetails nice to your prior question that I didn't finish answering fully, which was the false positive question you asked. I mean, part of the reason, you know, where people are able to defeat the testing, as we saw in the Armstrong case and some others in the past, is because we set a threshold for positivity so high because we don't want any false positives. And given what's at stake for an athlete, the science is very, very, very conservative. So that's one point, and I think it plays into the question you just asked about the different substances that are coming on the market, whether from, you know, legitimate pharmaceutical companies or, you know, offline type laboratories, and it makes the effort to detect, given the, you know, high standards for positivity, extremely difficult. And it's why we've, you know, since our history, given $2 million plus dollars to research. We actually established a research granting entity called the Partnership for Clean Competition with Major League Baseball and National Football League and the United States Olympic Committee a few years ago, and we give, you know, over $3 million, budgeted over $3 million dollars a year to help develop tests that will go towards, you know, better science and ensuring athletes that, that use these drugs aren't able to get away with it. There's a new tool called the Passport. Some of your listeners may have heard about it before, but it really takes a longitudinal view of a particular athlete's sample. It's not unlike some of the doctor tests that you see with cholesterol. You know, where was your cholesterol a year ago? Where is it today? Where is it going to be in 6 months? And it looks at variations in biological markers in the blood and the urine over time. And that really, we believe, and we're actually hosting our 11th annual science symposium later this year in Indianapolis, where we're going to examine that tool, and it's one we currently use and have used for several years now, how we can even make it better to be sort of the cutting edge and hopefully the game, you know, changer from our end. It gives us the ability, regardless of, you know, the new drugs pharmaceutical companies are putting onto the market that would give athletes huge advantages. How can we use this tool to ensure our athletes, you know, aren't able to use it without detection?
We have an interesting email here from Mary who says, it seems to me there's a major loophole in worldwide testing. USADA does a great job of being completely forthright no matter who the athlete is, but in other countries it seems doping agencies might not want to find a top athlete to be guilty, for example, Jamaica. Mary asks, is there a way to have all of this independently administered via WADA internationally?
Yeah, great question, and it's one we're, you know, extremely concerned about, as are our athletes. I mean, we're thankful that that is now the question, because the, you know, 10 years ago, quite frankly, the question was, why is the U.S. so far behind? So I'm glad that we're now in a leadership position, as are our athletes, because what's really unfair is for any athlete who, you know, is clean to be questioned that they're not clean or falsely accused that they're not clean because of a performance or, you know, a race result or whatever the case may be from an athletic performance standpoint and, you know, achievement standpoint. And so we're glad to lead on that topic now. We certainly have pushed WADA and will continue to push WADA. We also work individually with independent organizations around the world where we're able to. We also utilize some of our testing resources to test those athletes when they're here in the United States. And many athletes, whether it's Jamaica or other countries, send their athletes to our college programs. And we've got to ensure that we have adequate testing on them while they're here and we have jurisdiction over them as well. But certainly we want our athletes who are held to the highest standards when they make it to the international competitions to be competing against other athletes who are also held to the same international standards, and so that no one at that level gains an unfair advantage. And it would be particularly tragic if our athletes lost because they were being held to a higher standard than other athletes around the world, and we're working really hard to ensure that that doesn't happen. And look, I think out of London, U.S. won the most medals, had better success than it did. And you know what? That brings us a lot of satisfaction that our athletes can still win when they're held even to the highest standards and that other countries aren't that far behind.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Chris in Plano. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Mr. Taggart, really appreciate your work. Got to say, initially I was skeptical, but I think the evidence is pretty clear. I wish you'd achieve what you did achieve much earlier. I was a cyclist that competed internationally on the U.S. cycling team and competed against a lot of the people that you've come to know pretty well. And you know, for personal reasons, wish it had come out earlier. I now have an 18-year-old son who's following in my footsteps, and I'll say I personally, but he's heard some of this too. Cycling clearly has had a problem. It deserves its negative attention, but when I go to events now and when I talk to people about what I accomplished and what he's accomplished and when he does that, he frequently hears, what are you on?
Hmm.
And, what's frustrating is it's so clear if you just look at objective evidence like weight that, you know, high school kids don't naturally maintain a lean body mass of in excess of 300 pounds. And grown men playing in the NFL don't don't maintain a lean body mass of in excess of that weight either and run the 40 times that they run, cycling's getting so much of this attention. And again, it deserves it, but there are other sports that deserve it too. And
Thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate it, Chris. Let's make sure we have time for Travis to respond.
Yeah, Chris, thanks for the call and thanks for your kind words. I agree wholeheartedly with what you said. I mean, we believed in the Lance Armstrong U.S. Postal Service team until we could believe no more, and the evidence presented itself, and it was not an easy situation. So I appreciate your the comments that you made. I think we haven't seen the evidence in other sports since Balco. And certainly I got, and as an entity, we got the same question that you just asked back in Balco, back in 2003, 2004, when track and field was exposed as having a dark underbelly to it. People said, well, what about other sports? And so I'm glad to see you take it not as a defensive mechanism to move the problem to some other sports, but accept it within the sport of cycling and that we did what we had to do because the evidence was there. I certainly haven't seen the evidence in the other sports. I mean, we don't have jurisdiction over the pro sports here in the United States particularly, or the college programs. And I wish they had better programs in place. Certainly baseball today with the Biogenesis, the 20-plus people, athletes and others who have been disciplined have had a situation that they're dealing with now. So I don't think they're all immune from the questions that are being asked. I would tell your son, one, do it the right way. Be prepared. I think it's overly unfair when athletes are questioned, whether in cycling or any other sport, because they had a good performance or because of the way their body looks or a VO2 max or whatever the case may be, that someone is going to, without basis, accuse them or imply or infer that they're on something. So I think that's a result of a few bad actors in the past who have painted the tens of millions of athletes who are out there doing it the right way, hopefully, Chris, like yourself when you competed, and who are going to now take a stand to ensure that this sport, cycling particularly, doesn't go back to what we demonstrated and what the reality of it was, where young athletes really had no choice but to use these dangerous performance-enhancing drugs. And I hope kids like your son who are coming into the sport will stand up for it and say, we're not going to tolerate those who are coming in here and cheating us or forcing others by their cheating to use these dangerous performance-enhancing drugs as well.
Travis, what can you tell us about the ease with which young athletes who may not be at the sort of elite levels that USADA would be testing, but who think that they'll get a boost and maybe they make the varsity team at their high school or that sort of thing? How easy is it for young people to have access to these substances, and what can parents and coaches keep an eye out for?
I think it's relatively easy if they're not in any testing programs, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And I think it's Russian roulette when kids can go on internets or go across the border or go into, pharmacies and buy things, that can cause great harm to themselves. In fact, there's a tragic story out of Plano, Texas. Taylor Hooten, young athlete on the Plano high school team, baseball team, who felt pressure to get bigger and went to steroids, anabolic agents to use those, and then ultimately committed suicide. One of the classic side effects when someone comes off of a steroid cycle is they go into depressions and can cause harm to themselves, sort of opposite of the aggression that you hear about steroid rage or roid rage when they're on those steroids. So you can't underestimate the impact of these from a health standpoint on kids. And I hope parents, you can look at our website, but also truesport.org, that has a number of, resources for parents, how to be a true sport parent, how to, appreciate winning and push your kids to win, but how to do it in a framework that doesn't cause them to go over the top and resort to these dangerous performance-enhancing drugs. You also have to combat it from nutrition and give them the tools to know how to get bigger, stronger, faster, the right way. And certainly our nutrition books and other resources go to that effort. But it's going to take parents and coaches to have real candid, honest discussions with athletes, educated discussions with athletes, to ensure that they do it the right way and don't endanger their own health in the process of trying to become a champion.
How important was catching and disgracing Lance Armstrong in terms of his sort of symbolism as, an object lesson for others?
You know, our case was never about Lance Armstrong. In fact, we gave Lance Armstrong the opportunity to come in and be part of the solution to cleaning up the sport itself, just like we did all the other teammates of his. And we had, as I mentioned previously, 11 now, closer to two dozen of them have come in and have been truthful about what's happened and have been part of the solution and are doing educational forums and are, helping provide information on how we can better our testing and get rid of the doctors and the coaches within the sports system. So it was never about Lance Armstrong, and quite frankly, the lowest point of our investigation was when he, refused to come in and be part of that solution. And look, we've been clear, the opportunity for him to do that still exists, and we would, love for one day him to come in and be full and truthful with us on everything that he participated in, and we would do everything possible, just like we did with the other riders, to help them regain their credibility. And look, they're not axe murderers. They made decisions to cheat in sport, and so we don't like to see the downfalls, as you suggested in the question. We want to have these athletes embrace how we can do things collectively as a sport better going forward. And our number one goal, in addition to protecting the London Olympic team to ensure no cyclists who had cheated were on that London Olympic team in 2012. Was to change the culture of this sport. And we knew we needed the athletes' participation because it's their sport, and they have to stand up and embrace a clean environment, or it will continue to be a dirty environment. And so we tried to give every one of them, including Armstrong, the opportunity to be part of that solution.
We have about 40 seconds left. How does the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency measure progress?
Certainly from, we have objective testing numbers and that, and staying within our budgets and having good governance. At the end of the day, it's a movement to change the hearts and minds of thousands and millions around the world of athletes and give them hope. And we hear every day from parents like Chris, who just called in, but, 18-year-olds like his son who have said, look, thanks for validating the decision I made not to cheat. And we will be working with you and embracing a clean culture going forward. So thank you, and thanks, sport, for finally having an independent organization that can do that successfully to give hope to athletes that they don't have to use dangerous performance and enhancing drugs in order to achieve their athletic dreams.
Travis Tigert is CEO of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. You can find them online at usada.org. And Travis Tigert will be speaking at SMU's McFarland Auditorium at 7 in the evening on August 27th. You can find information about that event on the Think page. Travis, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Chris, thanks a lot. Thank you for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. If you have comments, questions, or suggestions for the show, you can email them to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.